Okay, we're back on recording. And let's see, what do I want to do? I don't need to look over at that screen. I just need to look over here. Okay, so announcements. There's a new website. So the new website is chemed.study. And you just hit, it's https://chemed.study. And I've moved all of the resources over to that new location. So all the recordings are going up on the chemed.study site rather than going up on the Cabrillo site. And that's because Cabrillo was destabilizing with the number of people that were putting videos up on the Cabrillo site. And they asked us not to do that anymore. And the alternatives that they gave us were to keep the videos up on Zoom site or to put the videos on the YouTube site. And I felt like YouTube was just gonna, while you could use that, there's so many advertisements and everything that comes up on YouTube that was gonna bug the crap out of me to see that in that context. And to have it on the Zoom site, I didn't have confidence in Zoom right now, given everybody that's using it. So I felt like moving them to a new location. And so I bought a domain name, chemed.study, and created a new site over there. And it's just a mirror of the Cabrillo site, but that's where all the new content is going to go. So eventually I'm going to take down the Cabrillo site and just use the chemed.study site. So you may, if you had the sites bookmarked, if you had the pages bookmarked, you may want to go reset those bookmarks to the new chemed.study. So that's where everything's going to be. And let's see, what else do I need to tell you? I don't know. I think that may be the only thing so far. Oh, and because I was trying to get that website up so that I could make sure that I get the content up, because people were looking for the lectures in particular. Some people are not able to join our lectures right now. They're working at different jobs or volunteering at the hospitals and not able to view the lectures in real time. So I wanted to be able to get that content up quickly. And the nice thing about chemed.study too is it's a lot faster than the Cabrillo website. So when I've been testing it at home here, and I pull down that content, it comes down a lot faster than it did off the Cabrillo website. So hopefully that's an improvement and will help you guys out. My only concern, I don't know how many people have tried to go back and watch the videos. My only concern is that these videos are long. You know, they're an hour and a half to 2 hours long, depending upon the lecture. And I know that videos are best in like 15 minute at most. And they even say 6 minutes. If you can do like a concept in 6 minutes and then put up small incremental videos, that's better, but it doesn't really work for our lecture setting. And I don't know how to tackle that. I don't know if you guys have tried to go back and watch the videos, if they're helpful, or how you guys have been trying to use those videos. The notes, when I look at the PDF of the notes, they seem to be less helpful to me to look at the PDF of the notes only because the notes are dynamic as I'm taking them. And I go back and I rewrite over them. And it's not as if they're incremental notes, and it would be hard for me to do that in a lecture setting. So it really seems to be that utilizing the notes along with the video seems to be the best resource. But I don't know, maybe you guys want to chime in and say what's working for you or not working for you, if you've got any particular comments in how this is working, or even the format and how the format is working, because I've kind of come up with my own format, but I don't know what other instructors are doing. And so I don't know how this video that I'm creating and using the iPad is working versus what other people are doing. And so maybe you guys want to chime in and give me a little bit of feedback. Lecture notes and the lecture is great to go back and be able to watch the whole thing. Thanks, Kylie. Anybody else have any feedback for me so far?
I think that like really long lectures are kind of like not the best, because I mean you kind of get bored.
Absolutely.
But it is hard to separate the lab into different sections, just because like if you stop you kind of forget what you were doing in the last video.
Yeah, I agree. Now, one thing that I could do is I could edit the videos and chunk them up into smaller sections and try and do that. That adds a greater complexity to it by me going in and trying to edit the videos and to break them up by little content sections. it would be nice if there was some sort of index in the video that you could just jump to a section and say you wanted to see how to set up the distillation or what that distillation glassware would look like. There was a link that would just take you to that section in the video. I don't know how to do that just yet. So maybe those are all things that I can play with and try and sort out, because it looks like we're going to be doing this for a little while. But yeah, the longer video definitely can get boring. There's no music. It's just me talking. And so I try to keep it as dynamic I can with my voice, but I can understand this is not the best format that we could come up with. But I think that the iPad is pulling, and the ability to be able to see the iPad as a whole whiteboard separately from watching me try to draw on a whiteboard, or what other instructors are doing trying to draw on paper with a camera over their shoulders and things. I think I've hit on a method that seems to be working pretty well in that regard.
You said it would be great if we had an index for.
Yeah, I just don't know how to do that though.
You could, something you could do is when you could review the video and then see where you have like major parts and just give us the time.
Oh, put a timestamp in there. Okay, that's a good idea. Manually. Yeah, I like that. Timestamps for different subjects. You know, that means I got to go watch an hour and a half of my own video listening to myself talk. That sounds like fun. But yeah, I can certainly appreciate having the timestamps in there. Thank you, Francisco. That's a good idea.
Hey, welcome.
Anybody else? Just trying to figure out how to make this better for you guys. You know, one thing that would help me out too, that that you guys haven't done yet, some people have, Katrina's got a picture up, Sarah's got a picture up, Francisco's got a picture up, is go to your profile and throw a picture in there on your profile so that I can see your smiling faces while we're going through and do this. Just grab a Facebook photo or some great photo of you, throw it up there so that I can see pictures of you while I'm going through here, rather than just looking at a blank page of names. That would help me out a lot too. Okay, so we left off and we had gone through all of distillation. The only thing that I hadn't done in distillation was azeotropes. I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about azeotropes, a little bit of time talking about vacuum distillations, and then to look at the gas chromatography and to spend a little bit of time on gas chromatography. And I don't expect this lecture to be nearly as long as what we did the other day. I think this is going to be a shorter subject lecture, and hopefully we'll see where that goes. So let's spend a little bit of time talking about azeotropes. Okay. If you guys don't have any other further questions, that we can jump into it and go that direction. So an azeotrope, sometimes what happens, let me see what glasses, okay, I got the wrong glasses on for this. I've got standard lenses that are flat lenses that are all one magnification that work really well when I'm working on a computer screen and I can look at the screen and I can see everything really clearly. And then I've got a pair of progressive glasses that have high magnification at the bottom and no magnification at the top. And those are really good for looking down on an iPad. But trying to go back and forth and find one pair of glasses that does everything that I want it to do is a little tricky. All right, azeotropes. And I am recording. Yes. Okay, we're good. An azeotrope is a non-ideal solution. So before, what we had is we had ideal solutions that followed Raoult's law. And the Raoult's law said that we could separate out solutions if we had a big enough difference in boiling point and a big enough column. And what Raoult's law said was that the constituency of the vapor phase was different than the constituency of the liquid phase based on the boiling point of the solution. And that came about because of the mole fraction aspect in Raoult's law. And that was all ideal solutions. An azeotrope is non-ideal solutions. And their curves look a little bit different. So let's take a look at what a standard heating curve looked like for an ideal solution. And this was that sort of football-shaped curve. And so we have a point up here and a point down here, and we had the two curves, one that gave the liquid composition and one that gave the vapor composition. And so we had 100% of A out here, and we would go down to 0% A and 100% of B and 0% of B on that size. This was the boiling point or the temperature. And we said that for any given point, the vapor composition had a different, so this would be the vapor composition. And the liquid composition. And this was Raoult's law and an ideal solution. In an azeotrope, for reasons that have to do with the intermolecular attractive forces being either repulsive or being slightly stronger than they would in an ideal solution, we get an azeotrope. And the azeotrope has a point in it in which there is a consistent boiling fraction. So what you have is 100% of A going down to zero and 0% and B, 100% of B. Oop, wrong. Let's see, what was I using last time? Okay. And 100% of B and the boiling point. And it looks non-ideal. This is still vapor on the top and liquid on the bottom. But what we have is we have a point here where it's a constant boiling fraction. And there's two types of azeotropes that we can get. We can get an azeotrope where the repulsive forces, that there are some repulsive forces making the vapor pressure higher than it would be normally. And that's the type of azeotrope that we're seeing here. So let me grab this picture and sort of explain this in a little more detail. We'll go down to a new page and take this azeotrope and explain what's going on here. So in this type of azeotrope, this is coming about due to some repulsive forces between the two materials. As the two materials repel one another, if we think about it as A and B, and there's some sort of repulsive force between the two, what that does is because the intermolecular attractive forces are kind of pushing each other apart, it increases the vapor pressure at a particular point. So this results in increased vapor pressure. For the mixture. And it's an increase in vapor pressure in both A and B. And what happens is as that vapor pressure increases, it makes this constant boiling fraction point. And that means that no matter where you're doing this distillation, as you start to distill, one of the components will distill out until you hit that constant boiling point, and then the distillation will not change constituents coming out until all of one of the components is removed. And some examples of this that are this type of azeotrope. This type of azeotrope has ethanol and water. So these are examples. Ethanol and water have an azeotrope that looks like this. And the azeotrope boiling point and composition, let's see, how do I want to construct this table? I want to make a little table here. Let's move this down a little bit. And these will be azeotrope examples. So we have the components. We have the percentages and the boiling point of the azeotrope. So the components here, ethanol comes out in 95.6%. Water comes out in the 4.4%. And the boiling point of that azeotrope is 78.17 degrees Celsius. What this means is that if you have ethanol and water, and you are distilling ethanol and water, that you cannot separate the ethanol from the water greater than 95.6% ethanol and 4.4% water, because they azeotrope together, they co-distill, and they co-distill in that fraction. Because of the carbon, the hydrocarbon component of ethanol, this component here, which is nonpolar, repels water a little bit. And that repulsion of water causes an increase in the vapor pressure of both the ethanol and the water, such that they co-distill in that percentage, and you can't resolve them or separate them to any greater degree, which is really kind of cool. It means that you can never get ethanol pure without water in it by just distillation, unless you use some interesting sort of tricks in order to be able to do it. And there are a large number of solvents that do this. And there are binary azeotropes. There are also tertiary azeotropes, which are also kind of cool. And so sometimes you're trying to separate two materials and you can't. And the reason is because they're forming an azeotrope. And sometimes we discover new ones in that way. Another really common azeotrope is toluene and water, and benzene and water, because of their common. So this is toluene and water will also azeotrope. They azeotrope around 98 degrees, and they are 98% and 2% in terms of the water, and they also azeotrope together. And we use that azeotrope, that ability to use toluene like that to remove water, is used in certain types of distillations to actually put toluene into the component mixture and azeotropically remove water. So this is a common way of actually getting water out of a chemical reaction and removing it when a chemical reaction evolves water or makes water and the water is problematic. So let me show you how we do that. We use an apparatus that's called a Dean-Stark trap. So a Dean-Stark trap, excuse me, a Dean-Stark trap has a specially designed piece of glassware. It looks like this, where it has an arm that comes out and down. This piece comes down and goes down to a ground glass joint. The arm over here comes down and usually goes to a point at which there is a ground glass joint here and a stopcock. This is got gradations on it so that you can measure volume. Your round bottom the chemical reaction fits onto the bottom of this guy. And then we usually put a condenser up on the top of this. And that's a double-walled jacketed condenser. And so that water can go into that condenser and water can come out. So we've got water going in, water coming out. So there's the condenser component. And inside here, what we would have is a chemical reaction. And the reaction would be a reaction that maybe produces water. So a condensation type of reaction, one of the types of reactions that might be a condensation could be the formation of an imine. So if we take an aldehyde and we mix it with an amine, R2H, we use a little bit of acid catalyst in this, we can make the imine. I think I only want one R group on there. We'll put two hydrogens. We can make the imine, plus we evolve water. But this reaction is reversible. So one of the things that you need to do in order to make this reaction work really well is you need to find some way to get rid of the water, to remove the water. And that's what this Dean-Stark trap allows to happen. So what we do is we put this in toluene and use toluene as the solvent, because toluene will azeotrope with water. So the first thing that you do is you fill the Dean-Stark trap with toluene. So on this side, we fill this up with toluene all the way up to the top. And then the reaction is taking place in toluene as well. And water is being evolved in this process. So there's a little bit of water that's coming out into this toluene. As the distillation goes on and we heat this thing up, what winds up happening is toluene is going up in vapor phase and it's carrying some of the water with it as the azeotrope. So water is coming in here as well. And water winds up going over into this other side. And as the water goes into the other side, it builds up in concentration such that it separates by density. Remember that water has a density of 1.0. So the water starts to build up in here, separating by density. And up in this part, the toluene has a density which is approximately about 0.7. Most hydrocarbons are 0.7 in terms of their density. And so the water separates out based on its greater density. And then what happens is flow-wise, toluene, as the water builds up in this side piece, clean toluene flows back the other direction and the water gets trapped in the bottom of this. So the toluene is basically recirculating, going back down into the round bottom and pulling out more water and carrying more water over into the trap component. So this piece here is acting as our trap. And we can actually measure the amount of water that is evolved in the chemical reaction based on the scale that's on there. And you can tell when the chemical reaction is done when you have evolved a stoichiometric amount of water based on its volume. And so this Dean-Stark trap and the azeotrope allow us to actually physically remove water in a chemical reaction just by using that property of an azeotrope. Okay, I don't know if I got that point across in how that works or why azeotropes are kind of important that way. So azeotropes both can be problematic because it can be very difficult to remove a component, or they can be beneficial. We can use them to remove a component selectively, such as removing water, and they come about because of non-ideal solutions. So we looked at a solution here, an azeotrope, where the where there are repulsive forces. So this is due to the repulsive forces in this azeotrope with a higher vapor pressure. So this is an increased vapor pressure that results in that. If you have attractive forces would result in a decreased vapor pressure. So we can have another type of azeotrope that looks slightly different. So this is an azeotrope with attractive forces. And the attractive forces in this case cause a decrease in the vapor pressure rather than an increase in the vapor pressure. And if we decrease the vapor pressure, that means that we need to hit the temperature a little bit higher in order to be able to get it to distill. So this is an azeotrope that has attractive forces. And again, we are at the vapor composition and the liquid composition. Same thing over here, vapor and liquid. And this is a constant boiling fraction. This is the azeotrope that is here. And this one is resulting from increased IMF forces that decrease the vapor pressure. Some solvents that do this, let's see if I had a list, acetone and chloroform are this type. So acetone and chloroform, CHCl3, they have a boiling point which is 64.7 degrees, and they co-distill in a fraction which is 20% and 80%. And you can't resolve chloroform and acetone better than that, based on that azeotrope, until one constituent runs out. So let's say you're distilling and you have a mixture that is acetone and chloroform. Once the acetone has completely distilled out of the mixture, then the chloroform will distill at its boiling point, which is a lower boiling point than the azeotrope was. But and I don't know of any situations where we utilize acetone and chloroform in that same sort of Dean Stark apparatus, but there's no reason why you couldn't. You just need to have two solvents that will separate, that are immiscible in their higher concentrations, and that one has a greater density than the other, and then you can utilize the Dean Stark trap. Dean Stark traps are almost exclusively used for separating out water using benzene and toluene and solvents like that. That's the main use of the Dean Stark trap. Okay, so that covers azeotropes. Do you guys have any questions on azeotropes before I move on? Nope, you guys are quiet this morning. You're willing to take whatever I say, and it's all good. All right, let's look at vacuum distillations. Okay, so for vacuum distillations, I was playing this morning, and I drew up a vacuum distillation. Let me grab this, and actually I'm going to grab one other distillation first. I drew this morning too. I was playing with my drawing skills. Oops. No. Go back. How did that even happen? Okay. I'm going to grab this whole thing.
Jason, you need to have like a tutorial on how you use your iPad, because you have some beautiful notes.
Thank you. The iPad is a great tool, and I basically learned how to use it by tutoring both of my daughters long distance. So as they were both in college up in Washington State, and they were both taking chemistry, trying to help them long distance was not easy. And I didn't use video chats. I just basically would be on the phone with them, and we would text back and forth the images from the iPad. So it was just drawing on the iPad and learning how to use the stylus And the iPad is pretty cool in terms of you can do things where you want to make a circle and you just get close to the circle and it will lock in if you just hold it so that you can make circles. If you want to make a perfect pentagon, you get close to the pentagon and hold it and it locks into a pentagon. It does the same thing for rectangles and squares, and then you can resize these too as you make them, as they lock in. So there's some ways to draw, but usually I'm just sketching. It's usually just using a stylus. And so I've just got an Apple Pencil and I'm just switching back and forth between the different sizes of nibs basically to draw whatever it is that I want to draw. But yeah, anytime you guys want to learn how to, if you've got an iPad and you want some hints, anytime. So this is a standard distillation that I've got up here. And the standard distillation, this would be a fractional distillation. So and this distillation, the one important piece is over here, is that this thing, the vacuum port, is open. And that allows the entire apparatus to be open to the atmosphere. And you've got water going in from the cold water tap. You've got water coming out, going down into a drain. You've got the jack stands, the heating apparatuses, everything supported. It shows where the clamps go. So this is a normal setup for a fractional distillation. And what I wanted to compare it to is I wanted to compare it to the vacuum distillation. And the vacuum distillation is a different sort of setup. And they're a little more tricky. And I didn't want to spend a whole lot of time drawing this, so I kind of sat down and drew them this morning. So here's our vacuum distillation. And this is a simple vacuum distillation. Simple meaning that the path, the column is short. And this is a vacuum distillation. So a couple of key things that are in here, and I'm going to see if I can use the eraser as a pointer. See if I hold that down. Not working. Come on. Usually I get a pointer out of that. It is not doing so right now. Oh, maybe if I use partial. There's my pointer. Okay. You guys can actually see the little bouncing circle now at this point, right? That was a cool tip. Okay, that's what I needed. Okay, so there's my little pointer. So in the fractional distillation, what happens is right over in this range over here where the vacuum port is, we connect the vacuum port to the actual vacuum apparatus and a trap. So we have a trap that goes inside here. We oftentimes have a three-way valve for safety to be able to control the actual vacuum. And then we oftentimes have some sort of meter, a manometer that fits on this as well. And then the vacuum pump that it hooks to. And the key to this is that the fractional udder flask is greased and is allowed to rotate such that as solution drips from this down into the round bottom, you can rotate to a new round bottom and collect a new fraction without ever having to turn the apparatus off. The only real difficulty and safety issues in a fractional distillation is the trap. This thing, you have to use caution. A lot of people will tend to use a very cold solution for a trap. They really don't want gases getting into their vacuum pump and wrecking their vacuum pump. And so they think that it's a good idea to get this as cold as possible. And sometimes what they do is they use liquid nitrogen. Liquid nitrogen has a boiling point of like minus 190 degrees Celsius. It's really freaking cold. And what happens is when you use liquid nitrogen, sometimes what can condense out of this is liquid oxygen. And liquid oxygen is extremely dangerous. Liquid oxygen, oxygen is an oxidizing agent. And anytime you do combustion, you are burning something in the presence of oxygen. But when you look at the oxygen in the atmosphere is less than 20% oxygen and it's 80% nitrogen. When you condense out oxygen in this way and you make it liquid, you have a high concentration of oxygen, and any organic material that hits that liquid oxygen will spontaneously explode. And what often happens is people will take apart the trap and go to clean the trap and think that the liquid that has condensed in there came out of their chemical reaction and don't realize that they have condensed liquid oxygen. I know of at least two people personally in grad school who had this explode on them. One of them was in the hospital for a long time, and the damage to the lab and the damage to themselves was extensive when the glassware actually exploded in their face. Lots of lacerations in the neck and the face. Fortunately, they had safety glasses on, their eyes were saved, but glass was embedded 20 feet behind them in the wall, which shows how explosive that can actually be. And it's not from the distillation itself. It's from not understanding that if you use liquid nitrogen as a coolant in that trap, that you can actually condense out oxygen and how dangerous that can actually be. So I tend not to like to use liquid nitrogen. I like to use a trap that is acetone and dry ice, carbon dioxide as a solid. And you mix those two together, and this equals minus 78 degrees Celsius and will not condense out oxygen. So what you do is you take acetone, put acetone in the trap, chunk up and grind up some dry ice, carbon dioxide, and throw that dry ice into the acetone. And that makes a cooling bath at minus 78 degrees C, which is plenty cold enough to condense any vapors coming out of the distillation apparatus, but not cold enough to actually condense out oxygen. So it's a much safer mixture to use. It's just, it smells bad. It smells like acetone. You have to deal with the dry ice. It's harder to do. Most people just find that to be a more difficult thing than going and grabbing liquid nitrogen and pouring liquid nitrogen in there. And the liquid nitrogen just evaporates into the atmosphere and you don't have to worry about it. The dry ice trap, you have to actually take the dry ice and the acetone, let it warm up, let the dry ice evaporate entirely, and then the acetone has to be hazed out. So there's pluses and minuses both ways, but for safety reasons, I always prefer the acetone and dry ice over that. The manometer is a cool tool. I don't know if you guys have ever seen them or used them. This is, in the manometer, liquid mercury, just like you would have in a thermometer. So this is HG liquid that's in there, and a vacuum that's at the top. And as you decrease the pressure on that system, it pulls the mercury down. And based on how far the mercury gets pulled down, the distance between this point and the top of this here, the distance between those two tells you what the pressure is in the system, measuring the different heights of the columns. And so a mercury manometer is a classical way of measuring the actual pressure within the system. And let me show you something. I'm going to switch out and see if I can go and stop. Actually, I want to screen share, but I want to go to my camera. Let me see if I stop screen sharing for a minute. And the camera comes up. I don't know that that's going to be helpful. Let me grab something for a second and see if I can make this work. Okay, so what I'm going to do is use the camera on my iPad, which is facing the wrong direction. Just turn around. All right, that might work. Yeah, I don't know if you can see this well enough. I don't even know if this is worth trying to show you. This is, maybe if I do it this way. pull back enough. Can you guys see the image that I'm trying to show? It's not going to show on the screen share. It's not going to show big. It's just going to show in my little icon. And if you switch to speaker view, I think you might be able to see it based on speaker view. Or maybe not. Maybe if you double click. Go ahead, George.
I'm just saying it looks pretty good from my computer. So good.
Cool. Okay. So this is a manometer that I made. And I made it because my stove broke. And I have a gas stove. And I wanted to measure the pressure in the valves and know which one was actually broken. And I called a stove guy, and the stove guy came out and he told me he couldn't figure out which one was broken because he didn't own a manometer. And he told me to call PG&E and have PG&E come out and take a look at it. And they could tell me which one was leaking and then he could come back and fix it. And because I'm building a trailer and I'm also concerned about gas leaks in my trailer, I figured, well, I need a manometer anyway. So this is a manometer that I just made from a ruler and a water tubing. And it's got the three-way valve down on the end of it so that I can let pressure in and out of the system. And this is just a water manometer, but it works exactly the same way. Right now, the two levels, because it's open to the atmosphere, are sitting at the same height. But as soon as I put pressure on it, the levels change and the distance between the two levels will tell you what the pressure is in the system. So manometers are not complicated. They're actually fairly simple. They just work on differences of heights of a liquid, be that liquid mercury or be that liquid water. And so you can deal with inches of water or inches of mercury or millimeters of water or millimeters of mercury. And manometers are a very old sort of tool, but a very accurate tool for measuring pressures. And that's why they use them for those vacuum distillations so that you can actually know what pressure you're at. Okay, let me go back to screen sharing and broadcasting. And we're back on. Okay, so that's a little bit about the manometer and how that works. And the vacuum pumps are just big, beefy vacuum pumps. They can usually get down into millitorr. So we're usually, when we're doing vacuum distillations, you need to be a little bit careful. The vacuum pumps are capable of going down to millitorr. One atmosphere equals 760 millimeters of mercury, which is equal to 760 torr. And the vacuum pump can usually achieve something on the range of 10 millitorr, which is pretty darn small. So what we do is we use that three-way valve in order to adjust the pressure using the manometer to set the pressure where we want it. There are tables that have curves on them that look kind of like this, where they have boiling point, pressure. So this would be standard. And then the adjusted boiling point. So basically what you do is you find your boiling point, you find your pressure, you take this across and you get your new boiling point. And we use the vacuum distillations by figuring out what temperature we want the system to boil at. So let's say that you have an oil and that oil boils at around 360 degrees. And that's the boiling point of the oil. And you want to do a vacuum distillation on this oil. There's no way you want to heat a vacuum distillation to 365 degrees. It's just too dangerous to heat it up that high. And so what we may do is we may drop the pressure down to something like 20 torr. And that may drop the new boiling point down to something in the range of 60 degrees Celsius. And so what we'll do is we'll use the manometer to dial in the 20 torr using the three-way valve to adjust to allow air in such that the pressure goes down to 20 torr, and then we'll heat the system up and do the distillation, and the material will distill over at 60 degrees. So that's why we do vacuum distillations. Vacuum distillations are for safety reasons for materials that have too high a boiling point to do the distillation at a normal temperature, or at its normal boiling point. So we reduce down the pressure within the system. Oh, I didn't show you guys the water demo, did I? I figured out how to do it for the afternoon class. You want to see the boiling point of water change with a vacuum pump real quick? It's kind of a nice demo.
Do it.
Let me see if I can bring it up. So I need to stop screen sharing over here. And stop screen sharing. And then we will screen share on this meeting. And now that I'm screen sharing here, I can go and grab a video that is in my extracurricular projects, ammonia chemical safety. And evaporative cooling. Okay, you won't hear the audio from this, but we'll be able to see what actually happens. Okay, so I'm gonna zoom through this video so it doesn't play as long as it normally would. You can see over here the vacuum pump, the desiccator. You can tell I'm in 607, that I set this whole thing up in 607. And inside the desiccator is a temperature gauge, a temperature probe, a beaker, and water that's in the beaker. So I'm going to zoom in on the top of that so that you can kind of see what's going on there. So you can see here the thermometer. The thermometer is reading 75 degrees Fahrenheit. The water that is sitting in here is at 75 degrees Fahrenheit. And this is a stainless steel temperature probe that is sitting in it. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to put the lid on the desiccator. So you'll see me grab the lid. You'll see me hook up the vacuum pump. You'll see I'll zoom in on it, and then you'll see my hand in the back reach over and turn the vacuum pump on. So as soon as I turn the vacuum pump on, I'm going to let the vacuum run for a second, and then I'm going to hit play. We'll watch and see what happens. So the pressure's coming down inside, and as the pressure comes down inside, the atmospheric pressure pushing on the water is decreasing. And as soon as the pressure reaches the vapor pressure of the water starts to boil. So you can see the boiling starting to take place. And watch the temperature. The temperature's 73 now. And look how vigorous it's boiling. It's boiling like crazy at 73 degrees Fahrenheit. Now 71. The water's getting colder. As the water is boiling, the water is getting colder, which is super cool. And you can see how fast it's getting colder. So now I turn off the pump. The water stops boiling instantly as soon as I turn off the pump. And I let the pressure back into the system. And once the pressure goes back in, everything's back at atmospheric pressure now, but the water has cooled down. And it was really hard to talk while the video is going on because I have my voiceover on the video playing through my ears. And I know you guys can't hear it, but I can hear it. And trying to talk at the same time as I'm listening to myself talk and say different words does not work so well. So that shows that you can boil water at any temperature you want just by adjusting the pressure on the system. And that's the same thing as a vacuum distillation. When you reduce the pressure such that the vapor pressure or the pressure on the system is the same as the relative vapor pressure of the liquid, the system will start to boil. And it also shows, you should do it with ice. What do you mean, Francisco, do it with ice?
You could drop the pressure.
Yeah.
And some ice in a beaker, and would it melt really quick and start boiling?
The ice actually would sublime. It wouldn't melt and start boiling really quick. It doesn't actually work that way. What would happen is if you dropped the pressure enough, the ice doesn't actually melt. the ice goes through a different phase change and sublimes and goes directly to the gas phase. So if you do reduce the pressure enough on ice, it actually sublimes. Caden, speed boil pasta. No, you can't speed boil pasta. Actually, what you would do is you would not ever actually cook the pasta. The pasta would just get colder. Because look at the temperature. The temperature went down to 68 degrees. It went from 75 to 68 in that short little term. The water boils at 212. And what you're doing here is by reducing the pressure, you're causing the water to boil. But it's not the boiling water that cooks pasta. It's the heat that cooks pasta. So when pasta is cooking, you're cooking it at 212 degrees. It's just that water happens to boil at that temperature. If you boil water at 68 degrees and you throw pasta in it, it's like putting pasta in water and watching it at room temperature. In fact, the water would just keep cooling down and the pasta would get even colder and it wouldn't cook. You'd have to sit there and watch it sit in that boiling water for 2 days before that pasta would be able to be edible and gummy. Yeah, that would suck. Okay, so the cool part here is that this video demonstrates a number of different things. It demonstrates how vacuum distillation works, but it also demonstrates evaporative cooling. Why did the temperature drop? Exactly, evaporative cooling. So let me go back and screen share my iPad, and I'll explain why that is the case. And it has to do with what's called evaporative cooling. So you guys know what evaporative cooling is. You've talked about evaporative cooling before, but not in this context. So in terms of evaporative cooling, if we look at a system, that did not go into a straight line the way I want. If we look at a system that is a Boltzmann distribution, and we have a Boltzmann curve here, and so this is percent of molecules, and this is energy. And this is the average energy and the average temperature. So these are molecules that are moving. If we look at the molecules that have enough energy to be able to evaporate. So this is the activation energy for evaporation. Then what happens here is that all these molecules that are the hot molecules, these guys are going to be able to leave the mixture. And as they leave through evaporation or boiling, then what you have to do is you have to re-average all of the remaining molecules. And as you re-average all of the remaining molecules, what happens is the new average looks like this. There's less molecules in the mixture, and you've pulled out all of these others. This is the new temperature, the new average, because you've lost all the high energy molecules. And so what happens is this is evaporative cooling. By losing all of the high energy molecules through evaporation or boiling, the system actually cools itself down. So evaporative cooling, another word or term for that could be auto cooling, that systems cool themselves down through evaporation. It's the same reason you sweat, is to cool your body down. It's through evaporative cooling. Your body uses the energy and the heat on your skin to evaporate water, leaving a colder population on the skin, which feels colder and is colder because you've lost all the high energy molecules. So great question, Francisco. Okay, anything else before I switch over and talk about gas chromatography a little bit? No, we're all good. Okay, let's go get a gas chromatogram, GC. Okay, this is our GC that we have in the lab, or what our GC looks like. Nope, went to the wrong spot. I wanted to be here, but I wanted to be in this window because I want all these notes in the same place. So we're going to look at gas chromatography. We were going to analyze our samples through gas chromatography. So we were going to take all these distillation samples, and then once we had them, we were going to take them and shoot them into the GC. So gas chromatography is abbreviated GC. And this is a mock-up of our GALMAC GC. And the GALMAC has two, let's see if I get that little circle coming back. Yeah, I think you guys can see the circle that I'm using. Has two ports that are injector ports. So these injector ports here are where the sample is actually injected into. And on these instruments, there are two injector ports. Usually they have two different columns that are connected to them, one to separate polar materials and one to separate nonpolar materials. So we wind up being able to use either one depending upon what it is we're trying to analyze. The instrument then has gas that flows through it. And so there are some valves down here to control the flow of the gas through the columns. There are or is a knob that reads out the column temperature, the injection port temperature, the detector temperature, the output temperature, and the bridge current that goes through the detector. And all of that is registered on the same gauge. The knob just controls what is being output to the gauge. And then the only other two controls are a bridge current, which tells how much energy is going through the detector. And we'll talk about the style of that detector, how that detector works. And then a zero, which allows me to be able to calibrate the instrument such that I can zero out the signal and baseline it to get it to a 0 point reading. So this is what the GALMAC actually looks like. And the amount of sample that we inject into these is really tiny. We use a very tiny needle. It is a 2 microliter syringe. And so the syringe has just this very fine needle on it. And this is 2 microliters that fit into the syringe. And so the actual body of the syringe is super tiny. And they're usually a very small glass syringe. And we usually wind up injecting 2 microliters into the GC. And that's all the sample that we analyze. So you can imagine that 2 microliters, that's 2/1000th of a milliliter that we're injecting into this. That's how much we're actually analyzing. And the way that the GCs work, notability has been crashing on me too. I have to restart it every once in a while. Fortunately, it restarts really fast. The way that the GC works is the GC is nothing more than an oven. So what I have is sort of an inside picture here, and we'll put that into the main notes. So the GC, looking inside the GC, it's nothing more than an oven that has a column inside it. And the column is a packed column. It is usually anywhere from 1/4 inch to 1/8 inch in diameter in terms of the column itself. And we usually record the column size. So this is 1/8 inch to 1/4 inch, depending upon size, in diameter. And there is a solid support material that has been placed into that column. And the column connects directly to the injection port. And there is a little rubber piece in there called a septa that you have to push the needle through. And then when you pull the needle out, the septa is self-closing. So the whole system gets closed back up. And once you inject your material into that, the material vaporizes and goes into the vapor state. And once it goes into the vapor state, it interacts with the solid support and it interacts with the traveling gas. And just like column chromatography or thin layer chromatography, the materials are separated out based on their polarity and their boiling point. And it has to do with the partition coefficient, how long the material stays bound by intermolecular attractive forces to the solid support versus how much time it spends in the vapor phase determines how fast it travels through the column. Okay, so the columns are generally somewhere between 6 feet and 12 feet long. And they're coiled up in there to be able to fit in there. And there would be two columns. I've only drawn one for simplicity, but there would be two columns. And then they go down and dump into a detector. And the detector is way more simple than what you might think. It's basically a light bulb. The detector is a metal box, and the metal box has a light bulb. It's not really a light bulb. It's a tungsten filament. And the way that it works is that bridge current that goes through there, the bridge current is how much current you're passing through the filament, just like a light bulb. And what happens is the gas comes out of this thing, goes past the light bulb filament, and then once it goes past the light bulb filament, oops, that is not what I wanted to do, I apologize. Once it goes past the light bulb filament, what happens is it then goes through an exit. So the gas goes in this direction, comes out and down past the filament, goes out through the exit and out through the instrument that way. And as the gas passes the filament, molecules hit the tungsten wire. So now I want to grab this piece here and we'll take this whole component over. I wasn't actually going to use all this. I was just practicing my lecture, but now that it's here, it seems like this is an easier thing to grab. I'll make sure that we put it in here. Okay, so I think I didn't quite hit in here, the injection port, out past the wire, out this direction, and out. And here's the tungsten wire. And it's just like a light bulb. That's exactly what it is. And what happens is, as molecules hit the wire, the molecules steal heat from the wire. They cool the wire down. So you can think of this just as collisional transfer of heat. And once the wire cools down, the conductance in the wire is proportional to temperature. And when the wire cools down, when there is a change in temperature, then I get a change in the number of millivolts that are passing through this wire. And that is the signal that is actually detected. So that when we look at a GC outtrace, the GC outtrace looks like this. We have time and we have millivolts. And as the GC is going on, as a compound starts to come through, the millivolt signal increases, and we will see different compounds come through at different times. And the area underneath that curve is proportional to the number of molecules that actually hit the wire. So the area is proportional, and that's in, area is going to be in millivolt seconds, is proportional to concentration of the molecule that actually hit the wire. The only thing is, it's not equal to, it's proportional to. And it's proportional to because what happens is every molecule has a different shape to it. And I haven't drawn molecules after, I've just drawn, you know, a diamond, triangle, circle and a blob, and the different molecular shapes steal different amounts of energy from the wire. And because of that, it's not equal to the millivolt signal, but only proportional to. And in order to get the equality, I need to go back and grab one more section that I had written out here. We need to talk about response factors. So the response factor is how we deal with molecular shape and the differences in the way materials react. So the concentration times the response factor is equal to the change in the millivolt signal. We can think of that as a y equals mx plus b equation, a straight line. And I want to erase whole. Just trying to get rid of that line in there. And if we think about that as the equation change in millivolts is equal to the response factor times concentration plus zero. So we've got the zero is B, because when there's no molecules going through, you're not going to have any signal. So the B is a zero. The X is the concentration. The M is the response factor, and the Y is the change in millivolts. So if I make a graph of millivolts versus concentration, the slope of that graph, which is called a Beer's Law plot, is equal to the response factor. And then I can use the response factor by taking the millivolt signal and dividing it by the response factor, and that gives me the concentrations. Response factors are unique for every instrument and configuration of that instrument, which means that you cannot publish a response factor and somebody else can use it. You have to actually do the study yourself on your own instrument, taking different concentrations of the material, injecting into the instrument, and measuring the response that you get, and then calculating out the response factor through the Beer's Law plot. And it is only valid for the instrument as configured. If you change configurations, if you change temperatures, or you change any of the variable settings on the instrument, you need to go through and remeasure the response factors for all of your materials in order to be able to then calculate out what the actual concentrations are that come out of that. So that's a little bit about GC. And other than that, how to actually run the GC and use the GC, that's a little bit harder. And we'll have some opportunity, I think, second semester, when we get into the second semester class, when we're actually back in the lab, to sit down and use the GCs and teach you guys how to actually physically use them and how to get the output of them. But basically what I did is these GCs were all made to be used with a strip chart plotter. These GCs that we have in the classroom are older than I've been teaching there. I think they're about 25 years old, and they were made to work with strip chart recorders. You think about an instrument that measures earthquakes, and you see the paper rolling past an instrument that measures earthquakes, and there's a Richter scale that measures the actual activity, the movement of the earth on the paper as the paper rolls past. That's what a strip chart recorder is. What I did is I got rid of the strip chart recorders, and I hooked up one of the Vanir probes. I used the Logger Pro software, and I wrote a little thing that takes the millivolt signal that comes out of the instrument and uses Logger Pro to record the millivolt change versus time. And then you guys can integrate it right there within the software and get the integrations for each of the outputs. And that's how we would have gone through and used the GCs. So I know that that's not a great GC overview, but it's kind of the best I've got without actually having the instrument there and showing you how the instrument actually works. It's kind of the best I've got. But let's see, do you guys have any questions in terms of the GCs or response factors or any of that? I know that went by kind of quickly, and I don't expect to do or ask you any great questions in terms of the GCs. I'm much more in terms of distillations, but I felt like that was a part of this experiment, and I wanted you to at least see how the GC is, and that it's not a black box, and that it's not as complicated as it might look, that the GC really is an oven with a tube in it and gas flowing through it and a light bulb that's used as a detector, and how simple a GC actually is in terms of its configuration, or how simple it can actually be, that it's really not that complicated a piece of instrumentation. So any questions in terms of what we've gone over this morning? No, you guys are pretty quiet this morning. All right, I think that's all I wanted to do. That'll give me some time before 11 to get this uploaded and get it online. And I'll remind you guys, because some people logged in a little bit later, that I've changed the website. So the website is now chemed.study, and you can access everything through the chemed.study website. And that's where I'll be posting all the new videos. So make sure you go there instead of the Cabrillo site. And I've got to go in and put a little link on the Cabrillo site saying that things have changed and that site's not being updated anymore. And I haven't done that quite yet. I spent all my effort just trying to get the videos up so that you guys had access to the videos. So that was the main thing that I was trying to do. And that means that I also did not put effort in to figuring out questions for the chromatography lab. And so I haven't done that yet. And we'll try to get that done as soon as I can. And I'll put a reasonable deadline on it when I do actually put those things out. But other than that, I think that's all I want to do today. So unless you guys have questions, I think we're good to call it and get set up for lecture and see you guys at 11:10 for lecture. So I'll just open it up for questions, and anybody who wants to stick around is welcome to stick around. And other than that, I'll see you guys at 11:10.
Thank you, Jason.
You're welcome, Anne.
Thank you.
You guys are welcome.
All right, Jason, to redeem myself from a stupid question. If you were to, you know how you make ice cream with like ice and the old school way in like a bag where you can mix them together and you put ice and salt and then you can like shake it and it makes ice cream. Could you make ice cream in that?
Could you, wait, I missed the last part of the question.
So in the vacuum sealed container, could you make ice cream by doing that?
Oh, okay. Now I understand. Could I make ice cream using the vacuum thing? That's a good question. And the other question you had was not a stupid question at all. The putting ice in it and melting it and watching it boil, what would have been cool was to put ice in the water and get the water cold and have ice and see the water boiling while the ice is in it. And the ice would not melt. The water would get colder and the whole thing would turn to solid ice. You could actually phase transition from liquid while boiling into solid ice. That would be a cool video. So it would just go a little bit opposite of what you were thinking. But making ice cream.
You should do that.
Yeah, that'd be a cool video. Huh? Making ice cream out of it is you probably could make it colder, but not efficiently, not as effectively as you could by dumping dumping salt into it. When you mix salt and ice, the ice goes from 0°C on down to minus 20. And that happens because it's an endothermic process of actually melting the ice, and the salt melts the ice and utilizes energy to do that. And it draws that energy from the cream that is in the inside of that chamber, making the cream minus 20°, which is what turns it into ice cream, because you need to get it colder than zero. So that's an energy-driven entropy problem. And it works better than actually dropping the pressure on the system. So while we probably could make ice cream that way, it would use a lot of energy and not be nearly as efficient. There is a video online, Dina, of, and I've seen it, and I don't know where I've seen it, I have to go look for it, of the triple point of water. What they did is they took the pressure and they set the temperature so that it took you to the triple point of water. The triple point is where ice, liquid, and gas all coexist at the same time. And what's really cool is the sample, you can see it ice over, and then it liquefies and boils, and there's solid while it's boiling, and then it will ice over really fast and then liquefy again and boil, and little chunks of ice are still in it. And it just is as confused as it could possibly be. And it looks like it can't figure out whether it wants to become solid, liquid, or gas. And it just flips back and forth.
And that's a triple point of water?
It's the triple point of water.
That was a triple point. I'm gonna look that up later.
Yeah, it's a really cool little video to see that triple point of water. Super cool. All right, guys. If there's no further questions, I'm going to log off, and I'll see you guys at 11:10.
All right. See you then.
Okay.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.